Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To. Our guest today is Sarah Pekkanen, and we're going to be talking about her latest thriller, Gone Tonight, which is her 13th book. 13th book, am I correct? And
Lucky number 13,
and a Book Reporter Bets On selection. Our Book Reporter reviewer, Rebecca Monroe, had this to say about it. It is rare that I am without words. When it comes to this novel, all I can say is, wow. The juxtaposition of chilling and heartwarming is startling and intense, and it's easily the best thriller I've read all year. Absolutely love that quote from Rebecca. I read this book standing by the side of the pool and was completely drawn into the story. And I just sat there doing this for hours. So with that intro, welcome, Sarah. So nice to have you here.
Oh my gosh, what a nice intro. Thank you. And I was so thrilled by that review as well. I love nothing more when people are like, you know, what you said, like, can't put it down, one more page, keep turning. And so writing like short, quick chapters, I want you to be able to do that. And I'm so glad it worked for you.
Completely worked. And you know what? It was a thing where we weren't really sure what was going on at the beginning of the story and what was going to happen and the way you unfolded it. Well, we'll get into that. But let's start by you giving those who have not been lucky enough to read this book an overview of Gone Tonight.
Yes, and it's newly out. So there are probably a bunch of people who haven't read it yet.
Exactly.
So Gone Tonight is a mother-daughter story. Ruth, who is 42 and a waitress, and her daughter, Catherine, who is 24. So you do the math, you know, Ruth was a teen mom, have always only had each other. They are a family of two. Ruth keeps in touch with no one from her past. She has a tracking device on Catherine's phone, and every few years they move, often with a day's notice. They have to get out of town. And Ruth conducts these drills where she'll spend 5 minutes seeing how much she can take with her if she has to go with no notice. Now that Catherine has become an adult, she's feeling a little claustrophobic. She wants to step out of the life she and her mom share, move to a new city, spread her wings, and Ruth will prevent anything to do that from happening. What you don't know as the reader is the danger coming from Ruth? Is the danger coming from Catherine? Or is the danger coming from the outside?
And that's what happens as you keep turning the pages. You start to figure this out. Now, back in your acknowledgments, you mentioned that your grandmother was an inspiration for this book. So tell us about that, because that's got to be some story.
Yes, and I love that you brought that up. You're actually, I think, one of the first, if not the first person who's asked about my grandmother. And because she lived a life under the radar, very much like Ruth, I'm super proud and happy to talk about her. So the similarity she and Ruth had, they don't have everything in common, but their similarities are both dropped out of high school to support their families. Both worked as waitresses their entire life. My grandma was in her 70s working at a bar as a waitress. Ruth, when we meet her in Gone Tonight, is in her early 40s, and she's also, you know, working at a diner as a waitress. And they both were kind of invisible to the larger world. And, you know, as Ruth would say in Gone Tonight, I've said 17 times before noon, hi, I'm Ruth, I'll be your server. Mm-hmm. And it's a safe bet nobody could tell me my name a minute later. But when, you know, my grandmother and Ruth had this in common too, they had this ferocity about protecting their children. They wanted their kids to have an easier and better life, and they would do anything to protect their kids. In my grandmother's case, this manifested when my dad was born with a heart condition and was told he would not live past his 20s. My grandmother became determined to find a solution to this. So in the late 1960s, this high school dropout waitress living in a house she and her husband built, her husband's an immigrant who doesn't really speak English, finds a surgeon in Boston and convinces him to do one of the first open heart surgeries in the country on my dad.
Wow.
I was just with my dad. He's 84. He's right. Alive because of that. So my grandma just had this nothing is nowhere is too far to go. Nothing is too deep, too hard to do for my kids. Ruth has that too, but because Ruth, you know, I write thrillers, things get a little dark and twisty. Ruth's story isn't that straightforward, although in her eyes, it's equally heroic.
Right. You know, it's interesting. My dad's in his early 90s, and he says, how did we feed everybody when we were growing up? How did everybody get shoes? How did everybody, he says, we never went without a meal. We never went without this. And he goes, my father, I know he worked at GM. My mother didn't work. And isn't it really interesting when we sit there and we think about all the things we need to do. And then you sit there and see how much they gave their kids along the way. It's very, very, it's just a different time.
It's a very different time. And I feel like the needs of kids are different too now with social media, with, you know, online credit, like all the different things.
Yes.
It's the time in which our attention spans are very fractured. That's one of the reasons I like books, because I'm like, it's one of the few places I can get lost. You mm-hmm. know, I'm actually taken away, and it can be for as many or as few hours as I want, but I'm stepping into another world, and I'm not hearing the ping of my email or the, you know, ring of my cell phone or whatever it is.
Right. That's exactly. You know, you write from two different points of view, Ruth and Catherine. Was one easier to write than the other, or was it, this clearly flows and then let me see how this one happens, or what were you seeing with this?
Yeah. So I usually write from two points of view. It's kind of the, you know, the thing that I've been doing for many books. Mm-hmm. And I really like that because you can leave one character in kind of a tough spot and pick up on another at a different point of tension. You can play them off each other. How do they see themselves versus how does the other see them? And Gone Tonight was a book that was a gift. I think every writer gets one. Gone Tonight was mine. It came to me. I would wake up at 4, 5 a.m., run down to the couch with my little rescue dog, a cup of coffee, and my laptop, and just furiously write. I wrote the book in 4 months, start to finish, which is a record. Yeah. And I just felt it was this gift. These characters became so vivid. For the first time ever, I had dreams. I was in a scene and I would hear Catherine and Ruth talking to me. And I would look around the scene. This is a place where Catherine worked, and I described it. And I remember thinking, oh, this is just how I imagined it. This is, yes, I remember, you know, this should be here. And it was surreal. I feel like my brain was always half in their world, and letting go of them as characters was heartbreaking. I miss them. I'm like, I don't want to let you two go.
Yeah, that's the reason 4 months is too short. You have to live with them for 12. Then you get tired. No, I'm teasing you.
Exactly.
Catherine works in a memory care unit, and you do a great job of taking us inside the various levels of care and also how Catherine interacts with so many of the residents. And it serves the book as it goes on. Tell us why you had her working there, because it was, wait a second, what can you do here? What can you not do? And it's also one of those places where there is a lot of protection of, we really don't want these people leaving. We want these people to be safe and careful. So talk to us about that.
Yeah. Well, that really, you know, books come to people in different ways. And mine start with kind of fragments, and I blend them together. And it can be like a snippet of a conversation I've overheard, a thought I've had, something I've read that sparks an idea. But this one came about, the very like little tiny nugget that turned into Gone Tonight came about because there's somebody that I know who was really struggling with mental illness, and it got really bad during COVID. And when I met with them, I thought to myself, she's disappearing. You know, the mental illness is consuming her right now, and she's not the person I know. And as I drove home, I started thinking about, what are all the ways women disappear? And I thought, you know, well, there's, you know, for thriller writers, the obvious, you know, they just appear disproportionately at the hands of predators. They, you know, we're always encouraged to lose weight, to shrink, to speak more softly, to be a little more gentle. We disappear into roles like motherhood or being a wife or whatever it is. And we let our identity slip away. And then I started thinking about, you know, what would be a way I haven't really seen in a thriller? And I thought, what if a woman was disappearing even to herself, if, you know, somebody's memory was being erased? And that led me to the setting of this memory care unit where Catherine works. And I wanted to get it right for a number of reasons. Even though I write thrillers, I really wanted to be very respectful mm-hmm. to the people who are in these situations and to make sure my characters treated them and saw them as whole people, people who were buried under layers of glycerin, as one of my characters put it, mm-hmm. but they were still there. Their souls were there. And whether it was music or whatever it was, that part of them could come out at times. And so I really wanted to get the research right, to talk to friends who had parents in memory care facilities, to read books about them, to go online, you know, enter chat groups, say, is it okay if I, you know, listen a little bit and really understand them well enough so that I could write about them authentically and fairly.
Mm-hmm. So you were a former reporter. Does that serve you as a thriller writer to know how I'm going to get the facts right? How I'm going to get the facts right to tell the story?
Yeah, I love research. In fact, my next book, which is not the one after Gone Tonight, I finished House of Glass, which will be out next summer, but the one after that I'm starting, and I get to do a really cool research trip that I can talk about when we talk next time. and I'm so excited. It involves flying cross country and immersing myself for a few days in a very unusual situation. But yeah, I'm a former investigative reporter. I love to geek out on research. I love to, you know, being a reader and being a writer, like you're stepping into another world. You're trying on this other thing, right? Whether it's somebody else's life, experiences, thoughts. And when you're investigating and researching, you're doing a bit of that too. You're kind of thinking, okay, I'm learning about this whole other slice of the world that I've never really known about, never really understood. And these details that make it three-dimensional are the most fascinating to me, the little things that make it just super cool. Yeah.
And deception is such a huge part of this book. It's sly in parts and starkly evident in others. What was it like writing those scenes where you're going to deceive us? But you've got to be authentic in that deception so that the payoff later on for us works.
Yeah. Well, my rule is you don't lie to the reader. I will not tell, and my characters will not lie to the reader. And I think that's really important because readers don't want to read you saying, you know, saying something. I mean, they can do the little, you know, sleight of hand and they can have you look over here and do something over here, but they can't outright lie. Maybe the reader and the other characters are going to jump to assumptions. But that's where I draw the line because you need to have the reader's trust, and you need to have them be able to look back and be like, oh, wait a second. Now I get it. This and this and this happened. Mm-hmm. And some readers love looking for those clues when they read and like predicting the twist. And others are like, no, I just want to go along blind for the ride and, you know, see what happens. But yeah, you have to, readers are very smart.
Right.
So you have to be super careful. And as a writer, you don't always have the perspective of, am I being too obvious? Am I being too fuzzy and hazy? Like, I don't want to confuse my reader, but I don't want to give it away. And that's when you need to have beta readers come in and say, like for The Wife Between Us, we had beta readers come in early on. And the first round, they were like, we don't understand what's going on. The second round, they were like, oh, we saw this coming a mile away. So we kept having to fine tune it because we had lost perspective. And that's one of the, you know, the things that's hardest about writing when you're living, eating, breathing this work for months and months, you really need sometimes to take a step back, look at it with a fresh eye yourself, but also get outside eyes.
Mm-hmm. There was a book I was reading, Ernoli Galeoff, last week, and they went for gas on page 198 and they went again on 199. And the author probably isn't seeing that at this point because there's been so much has been going on. And I just wrote and I go, they're getting gas twice. I think we need to say, and then they pulled into Iowa or wherever they pulled into so that there's some differentiation of the space they've traveled. And it's just like, that's a click, like, you know, everything else in the book, you're like dead on with, but those little things are the ones that, and you know, sometimes editors and copy editors do not catch them either. It's these things where, because they're reading it for intent of this or that. And also if you read a book too many times, I've seen some times where they said the editor read this book seven times. And I was like, somebody else should have read it the eighth because it's a little disjointed because all the parts are fixed, but they're not doing this. They're not. And what happens in your book is all the pieces do go like this. including being able to track people via phones, which has added something to the writing this day. But what it does is for you, it actually helps you as a writer to be able to track in this particular book of what you can do. Are you always looking for like, how am I going to use technology in a better way? Because instead of saying it's not going to work because it'll give away the story.
Right. Well, it's actually, you know, technology is not always our friend when we write thrillers, because it was so much easier in the past to, you know, sneak into some place without cameras being everywhere, or, you know, phone trackers or all of that. Like, it was much simpler. Now, a lot of times when I bring up plot twists, like for Gone Tonight, I was like, okay, when did cameras become common in gas stations? Because my character may or may not have been able to get away with this thing that, you know, she was in a gas station and I don't know if she would have been tracked. So I'm always having to look at, like, you know, when did this or didn't this happen? So technology, I think, is, you know, it's easier. Well, I don't know if it's easier for me in life. I think as what it goes to our conversation earlier about like all our parents had to do, I think technology is our biggest time suck. Right. But as a writer, sometimes I wish I could write like a book set in the 1960s where nobody could be tracked and my, you know, main characters could dart around and, you know, be sleuths and do whatever they need to do.
But the worst thing would happen is somebody else would pick up the landline while you were on it. But you know, do you also notice though, this is one that kills me, is you're watching the news at night and they have this really fuzzy picture of a guy and they're going, this is the perpetrator. If anybody recognizes him, and the next night the guy's arrested. Sitting there like, somehow from that little fuzzy thing, yeah, Somebody recognized who it was. And it's changed stories. It's changed what happens with trying to find criminals, trying to find people, mm-hmm, or whatever, completely, completely different. But meanwhile, we've got Ruth, who keeps notes in a notebook. And she gives us insight that she was not going to want to share with anyone. Was her writing in this book always a part of the storyline?
Yeah, I always knew that Ruth would need to reveal her past. And I had the idea that I'm going to start her in the present and, you know, bring in her past in her journal entries, and they're going to collide at some point. And Catherine's woven through it all. But I wanted to find an interesting way that wasn't flashback, mm-hmm, that I could tell, you know, Ruth's early story before Catherine was born. And I thought, you know, a lot of moms keep like baby books, you know, and Ruth is not going to have that baby book with the first lock of hair and the, you know, whatever the photo, but she's going to have like this old worn spiral notebook and pen. And she is just going to write the hard truth down in that for her daughter to read someday.
Yeah. And it's like that notebook. I also say that the baby book for my first son was very good. The second one, I think he got like the day he was born is written down. I'm not sure we have much more. Yeah. Really not sure.
You know, I hear you.
We also have to talk about lasagna pizza. Now, I love to cook and I have made both lasagna and pizza, but never together. Now, did you find a place that makes this? Do you make this? Is this on your website someplace, the recipe for lasagna pizza?
I should put it on my website. I have not made it, but I was looking for something kind of quirky, interesting, distinctive that not a lot of people would have tried because it's an important clue in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was just kind of Googling and I'm like, oh, lasagna pizza. And there are a few recipes for it. So I will make it at some point. I have not yet, but I'm told it's very good. And I love pizza. Who doesn't? I love lasagna. So someday, yeah.
Yeah, I sat there and I said to my husband, we've got to make this one at some point. We're known for cooking. So I said, we've got to sit there and move lasagna pizza and see what's going on.
Oh, you got to send me a photo when you do.
I do. I promise. Okay. We definitely will do it too. The book's separated into three acts. And what made you write it as act 1, 2, and 3 and add something really theatrical like that is what's coming into the book?
Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of, I think storytelling structure naturally breaks into three acts. And I think a lot of life breaks into three acts. Like you think about, you have maybe a slightly shorter, you know, life when you're growing up until you, you know, become kind of an adult. And then you have a very long middle adult period and then a shorter old age period. Mm-hmm. Like morning, and then you've got like the bulk of the day and night, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, like so many things about our existence breaks into those three. And that seems to be a natural way people tell stories. And it's always worked for me. So I knew I wanted to have my story told that way. And, you know, I love ending on a cliffhanger, a twist, an aha, a gasp moment when I'm breaking into the next act, because you got to have something to make people be like, what? Okay, one more page. One more, let me keep going.
Yeah, definitely you were doing that.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. You know, you want to have the mini ones like at the end of every chapter, but, you know, the big ones at the end of every act too.
Yeah. And then you were sitting there going, okay, am I going to learn more from Ruth? I'm going to learn more from daughter. Who am I going to be learning more from as the story goes on? And then the pace picks up as well. I felt like the chapters were getting shorter, that I was reading faster because we were on this little, we've got to go do the chase. We've got to do the hunt and figure out what's going on. So based on that, do you outline in advance? Do you know exactly where the story's going?
So Gone Tonight, I wrote a 5-page synopsis that I shared with my editor. My reason for doing that is I don't want to spend, you know, however many months writing a book and then giving it to her and her saying, oh, we got a really similar book coming out next year. Oh, you know, this kind of book doesn't really work. I hate this part. So I really want to make sure we are clear on the bones of the book and we're in agreement. And also she has great ideas. So she might, you know, weigh in with, well, what about this? Try this. So, you know, we hashed that out in a couple of phone sessions. I write up the 5-page outline. I send it to her. She might, you know, ask for another call to tweak it. Then I generally write a couple chapters. Then I'm off and running and I write the book. I used to outline much more methodically, but as I've gotten more comfortable writing books, I don't need to as much. But I have in my office 2 giant whiteboards. And as I'm writing a book, the top one, I'll write like chapter 1, point of view, Ruth. Ruth XXX, and it's just a few words, what happens in that chapter. Chapter 2, you know, point of view, Catherine XX. And as I'm going, I'm filling in kind of the outline so I can look and see, okay, here's where I've gone. The bottom whiteboard has, you know, just scribblings of, oh, here's a great song I've got a reference. Here's a keyword. Here are the 3 or 4 themes I'm working on in the book. Don't forget about, you know, this little piece. So the bottom is kind of like the scrapbook and the jumble, and the top is like the surgical, here's what's happened so far. And that's working for me now, but, you know, I love switching up my process. I love learning about new ways to do things. So it may not be forever, but right now that's really working.
Yeah. And you know what else too? It's just that place to write down notes. I mean, we write a newsletter every week and I actually write notes all week long. And so I actually know what I'm going to be like, oh, don't forget to talk about this. Don't forget to talk about that. And I talk about a lot of what I watch. And a lot of times it's really, I don't remember what I watched by Friday. And I'm like, how can I not remember what I watched? But you make these little notes to yourself all week. You can do it. And also if you're stuck, there's a word there that might get you started again. And I always feel that way when you're writing is sometimes you always write yourself into a hole and then you got to sit there and say, how do I get out? Oh, lasagna, pizza. I can go there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. It's like that. That's exactly right. You have that little inspiration, that little nugget. You're like, oh, yeah. That's the breadcrumb. And oh, you know, my dog is joining in if you hear her.
Okay. I also think that with editors these days too, it also has to be, is this right for your readership? Is this right for who you're writing to? Because sometimes it's a great idea, but it's not for your readers. It's not going to be for an audience that you're used to talking to. And I think the market right now is so fluid of what's going on. I mean, I keep saying that there's over 35 and under 35 of the way we're marketing to people. And over 35 is traditional, under 35, it's influencers or them being influencers. And it's a totally different way of looking at the market and looking at marketing books. And I've been seeing that happening really over about the last year. Everything is sort of like, you know, catapulted in a different direction. So, okay, you've got this outline. Do you always know, oh, look how cute. Your helper, right?
That's very insistent about joining. So
oh, good. That's like fine.
Wanted to see who you were.
You know, that's really funny. When you're doing interviews, a lot of times the dog comes running in and you realize it's this other voice that they can't see. And they are very protective of who's ever in the room. And I was interviewing a couple of weeks ago and finally she says, I've got to go get the dog because the dog is just going crazy. And I was like, I just thought of that now as the dog has no idea what you're doing. You don't hold the phone like usual. Like,
right. Who is this woman in the box talking? Like, and I thought you were on speaker, you know, resuming. So she checked you out. She decided you're okay. And she went to go lay in her bed.
So funny. That's so funny. So did you know the ending here with when you were beginning? You said you had the whole outline, but was the ending always like right there? And how are you going to race to it?
Yeah, the epilogue especially, I couldn't wait to write. And normally I don't write very much out of order. I start at the beginning and I generally work my way through to the end. Sometimes I'll write, you know, a scene I'm dying to write a little sooner. If I'm stuck and a scene isn't working, I'll go ahead a bit. But the epilogue, I was so excited and eager to write that I drafted it out pretty early, like when I was 70% of the way done. And then I'd go back and tweak it a little more. So I did know how it was going to end. And and I think having all that time to marinate in your brain too makes it flow a little bit more easily when the time comes to write it.
Yeah, well, the ending really grabbed me, what we learn. And the ending made me think back on the whole book and the characters. It made me think back on everything that's happened so far that would lead up to this, what we know and what we don't know about people, what we think we know about people, how people present themselves to us. And I thought that was completely well done. Am I dead on with what we're like, you know, it's perception and reality of what's really going on with these people?
Absolutely, you are. I mean, it there was enough ambiguity that I think, like, you know, you have to put together the clues. I'm trying to figure out how not to say too much. And I know you are too.
Yeah, exactly. But
I think that you could definitely make the case that the ending revealed something big about one of the characters that maybe you hadn't suspected before.
Yeah, did not suspect at all. So you wrote a number of books by yourself. You wrote 4 books with Greer Hendricks, your co-author. And then I remember hearing the two of you talk about this. And I loved hearing you talk about how you were writing together. I was at an event, it's got to be years ago, at the Clinton Bookshop. And I love that, you know, what's it like now going back writing on your own? I talked to Greer a couple of months ago, and it was like, you sit in the room and it's, I have an idea. Like, what do you think? Like, you're talking to yourself a little bit more. Now, you had writing by yourself before. So was it going back to old habits or what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I've always done different types of writing. So I was a newspaper reporter. Then I became a magazine writer. Then I was a magazine columnist. I wrote short stories. You know, I've had 4 published. I wrote in women's fiction, 8 solo books. I co-wrote 4 thrillers. Now I'm writing thrillers alone. So for me, part of the fun is like mixing up the process, doing different things, learning new things. I'm doing a little more, or I had been doing a little more screenwriting, you know, with The Wife Between Us and some other things. That's all on hold now with the strike. But so I really like leaping into something new and exciting, even though books, I'm going to do a book a year, I hope, for the rest of my life. But the big difference for me is that when I'm writing alone, I tend to be very solitary. It just goes brain, fingertips. I have music blasting or not. I'm in a coffee shop or I'm on the sideline of a soccer field, wherever my kids are. And I'm just kind of thinking and writing. When I'm co-writing, you know, I would have to talk. And so Greer and I would sort of laugh about it. I'd be like, I have to go brain, mouth, and then fingertips because, you know, we're bantering around with ideas and things like that. So it was like an added step, but I think it was a really valuable step for me to learn because I think it helped me become a little bit more analytical, and it helped me give like that extra like layer of, is this idea, you know, really going to work? Mm-hmm. So I love doing that. And, you know, when we finished our contract, I was like, I love the editor. We have Jen Enderlin and I mm-hmm. still want to work with her. And so she and I just signed a new 2 book contract. So I'll be with Jen and the same publisher for another 2 books after House of Glass, which I'm super excited about.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you know what, though? It's like having worked with someone else, you pick up skills. You pick up skills. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people who say when they first get out of school, I want to work on my own. It's like if you didn't work in a place, like I worked at Condé Nast for years. And the things I learned were about running a company, about how things, how things worked was a big deal. It was a really, really big deal.
Yeah.
And I think that working with somebody else, you also sit there and say, wait a second, should I really do this? Should I not? How would I have been stopped before? And I was thinking of you too during the pandemic when kids came back home and I'm like, how are those two going to write together? You know,
like, oh, it was tough. So yeah.
Go somewhere else, you know?
Yeah. I mean, our process totally switched up because we would have, you know, kids. I had contractors in my kitchen that was banging. The internet would go out. Like every 5 minutes, these kids wanted to be fed. You know, her husband would make smoothies right when we started to talk. I'd be like, rrr. So we would just laugh about it. So yeah, that definitely mixed it up. I mean, for us and for the rest of the world, that was pretty crazy. Yeah.
But, you know, we talk about how the children needed to eat all day. When they were at school, they had lunch at like 11:30 or 12. Now it was like a constant restaurant was going on, you know?
Totally. We're short order cooks and they all want different things. And we're order Domino's.
Now my younger one doesn't live here. And they'll say, do you want to come over for dinner? It's like, well, what are we having? And I'm like, does it matter? Like, does it really? But he cooks really well. So I could see that, you know? It's like, so who sees your work first when you finish it? Do you go to your agent? Does it go to Jen? Does it go to somebody else, a writing group? What happens?
Yeah. So Jen does not see it first. And here's why. Jen, as we've talked about, you know, she's not only an incredibly busy woman, but like anybody else, she has only so many fresh reads in her. Right. And I want to get her read when my book is at its best it can be, because she can always elevate it. But if I'm starting down here, you know, right, she might go here. If I'm starting here, she might go here. So I have beta readers. I have my agent. My agent's a very good reader. She gives great notes. Her assistant will read it. You know, friends will read it. I'll have an outside editor read it and give me notes. Then when I've figured out what suggestions I want to take and which ones I don't want to take, and I have different rules. Like if it grabs me, the suggestion as, oh, absolutely, you do it, I will take it. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't grab me, but more than one person brings it up, I have to take a really hard look at it. And if only one person brings up what they think is a problem and nobody else does, and it doesn't bother me, I generally let it go.
Okay.
Keep it as is. But Jen will get it last when I'm hoping it's in its best possible state, it's polished, and then she'll read it and, you know, generally write me a note and, you know, I'll make some edits and then we'll just go from there. It's usually one or two rounds of probably two rounds of edits.
Right.
Some are more extensive than other, depending on the book. House of Glass had my fewest edits by far for any book. Gone Tonight did not have a lot either. Gone Tonight was quick. House of Glass was very quick for whatever reason, even though it was a really hard book to write, it came out very clean and solid. But yeah, then Jen will read it. And then from there, it goes on to copy editing right after her.
And it goes like, just like, you know, from there, blah, blah, blah. So this is the 13th. You have you changed anything in how you write? Like, have you changed anything in, well, your confidence level is definitely there. Your research level is definitely there. Are there things that you sit there and say, I will allow myself this, like put XXX right now, or I will allow myself to do this because I know I can fix it later. And I'm not going to get hung up, because at the beginning I used to get hung up on X.
Yeah.
Happen then?
I definitely think I'm much more confident as a writer now, just even though I'm always like every single other writer I know, like, oh, this could all go away at any minute. You know, maybe and I tell myself, this is not a muse. This is not magic. This is a craft. You've been working very hard at your craft for many, many, many years. And, you know, it's like being a carpenter. You're okay. You got this. You know how to do this. I think writing the outline, or not the outline, the proposal gives me some confidence. Mm-hmm. If I figured out where I'm going, what some of the big twists are. And then when I'm, you know, filling it all in, I can kind of go off and do other things. And sometimes characters will do things that'll be a little surprising, or twists that I didn't plan will come. But I think as long, I could never write and just be like, I'm going to write a chapter and see what the character does. Cause I write thrillers. Like everything has to build on everything else. I can't go down these crazy alleys and not know where I'm going. So as long as I have that, I'm pretty confident, even though there does come a point in almost every book where I'm like, oh my God, how am I going to get out of this? Is this working? Is it terrible? Is it, you know, we all have these like moments of like the dark night of the soul of, oh, is anybody going to read it? Am I done?
Right, right. And then you read something else by somebody else. You know, oh, that's so good. How's mine going to, you know, stack up next to that? And yeah. I tell you, it's very, very hard right now for books. And I'm going to be honest about this. There are a lot of books. There are a lot of books out there. I just read, I think it was 10 books over the break. I didn't do much more. Let's get really real. I didn't do much more. I stood in the pool and read books. And I perfected this thing where I actually put weights on my feet so I can kick. So I actually feel like I'm working out, you know, like doing two things at once. Yeah, it feels really good though. No, I was actually did that this morning. I was like, wow, why do we have to stop this just because we were on vacation? Let's just keep up. But there's so much that I went back to read that came out in June, that came out in July, that I just missed. And it's not that they're authors that I didn't want to read. I have the books here. And it's just this plethora of stuff that's coming out. Somebody who's in my book club was just asking me this morning about a book that came out in June. And she goes, why did I not read this sooner? And I think about everything else you read this summer. And I think that we're in this moment where there's, you're reading debuts, you're reading somebody's second book, you're reading somebody's 13th book, you're reading somebody who you've been dying to get your hands on, you know, and I just think the marketplace is very, very crowded right now. And they say, oh, there are not enough readers out there, or readers aren't reading. And I said, I don't think that's quite it. I don't think people are reading on the momentum that we were used to of the first week, the second week, the third week, what it's going to mean. Things can bubble up later because people are finally finding the book, or if they have the book, they're reading the book. Am I making any sense here about what you're seeing in the market as well right now?
You know, one thing I am seeing that's heartening to me, because I think we've all heard that like people don't read anymore and everybody's, you know, on video games and we're losing, but I have seen a lot of women, because women tend to read more, you know, in general, women and younger women who are reading more. And I think Book of the Month, you know, that subscription club service has been great in attracting a lot of really devoted young readers. I think, you know, they are on social media as influencers. So I do get a lot of like 20 something women or late teenagers who love to read. And they're like, we are the ones who are the readers with all our friends. We're always recommending the books. And I'm so grateful, like this new wave is coming along of people who love books and who can and do spread the word about them. But yeah, there are a lot of books out there.
There are a lot of books out there. And you know what I'm also seeing too is when I got out of school, everybody's saying, oh, you know, everybody's reading romance or, you know, just life books and all this stuff. Look, when I got out, I was Danielle Steele, Judith Krantz. I mean, I have a whole shelf that's like not front and center downstairs, but those are what I read. Like that is, and I think that one of the things that happens is when you come out of college, okay, you first of all have read like the masters or the classics or whatever for years, and you don't really know what else to read. And they're still reading the same, I say dead white men, but I'm not being like, you know, crass here, that we were reading. So where have we changed the curriculum to move them along to be future readers of today, moving it up in the marketplace a little bit more of what they're reading? And if I'm making sense, it's like, you know, what Toni Morrison being taught in school, is this being taught? And I don't mean taught just in one class. I mean, across the board. And I had a class that was called Books That Changed America. That was amazing. Book That Changed the 60s. Amazing. And those courses brought you in line with, you were reading authors that had, you know, books that were centered during that time, but you were also reading stuff that was a lot more current than what we're doing right now. So that's one of my beefs. That's one of my beefs that I bring up when I'm talking, because I feel like they're not introduced. I mean, there are people that I've had friends have taught courses. They don't know some of the best-selling authors today. People are not aware of what they, like John Grisham. And I'm not kidding. This is what people have told me teaching classes. And it totally surprises me. But when I think about it, I was reading him when I got out of school. I was reading him at a certain point. I was reading him in 96. I was reading him whenever he started. We're like, okay, so what is their version of John Grisham? Got what I mean? Like, where are they picking up with? So I don't know. So tell us about the title. Was this always Gone Tonight?
So one thing that is not my strength is titles. Mm-hmm. And luckily my editor, who's a genius, is very good at titles. Yes. So I'm like, I got nothing whenever she asked me for a title. And she's like, all right, hold on, let me get on it. And, you know, that night at like midnight, she emailed me, what about She was like, initially I was thinking Gone Tomorrow, but no, that's not gonna work. Let's do Gone Tonight. That's more immediate. And I was like, you know, that sounds like urgent and muscular, which is how I wanted the book, you know, to feel. That sounds perfect. She is a really, her brain works in a lot of different ways very well. Where like, I think I can do some things very well and other things not well at all. Her brain seems to be like very multifaceted. And so she can like, tell you what the book cover should look like. If she reads it, she can like sum it up and pitch it. She can come up with the title. She can come up with a great, you know, line of dialogue to put in there. And so that's just, you know, one of the great things about working with her is getting to benefit from all of these sides of her brain. She has come up with titles for The Golden Couple. We wrote that off her title. She said, I got a great title, The Golden Couple. I think you guys can write a book around it. And we're like, all right, let's do it.
I love Jen. I love Jen because she is that multifaceted. She knows the business part of it, but she's got that editorial brain always working and thinking, where should we go? And the other thing about Jen that I love is she admits she makes a mistake. And there are a lot of people that can't admit that. And she'll sit there and go, you know what? No, that don't do that. We'll go in this other direction instead. And I really like that about her. We haven't had lunch in a while. I've got to do that because she's really cool. She actually grew up in my town. And we'll sit there and have these great conversations because she sees like that the big picture with her authors. And she's also such a champion of her authors, which is really, really lovely of like, you know, how can I make their book stronger? How can I make it better of what they're doing? Which is really, really lovely as well. So let's talk about this cover. Cover, like she says, like, this is what we should do. I've got this silver, like, you know, they're gone tonight. It's like, wow, is that the drape? And they're out the window and they're gone, right?
Yeah, she told me, you know, she gave the art director, Michael Storing, some general direction. Like, I want it very simple. I want it very stark. And he came up with that. And, you know, I don't know how many different possibilities they went through. They usually just show it to me when they either have one they love or, you know, a few to choose from. I think one slight change I asked for, I said, you know, what do you think about maybe having the flames in the lettering of Gone Tonight, like slightly darker or something like that.
Right.
And they did it both ways and everybody voted on it. And that was kind of my one contribution. But I love the cover. You'll notice my name is embossed. If you feel it, I'm like,
I can feel this. You're like kind of glaring over here. Yes, your name's embossed. I love this.
I love it. So yeah, you know, it's always so cool to see your book cover and to think like, oh, like, holy cow, like this is now a thing. And before it was just a pile of pages. Now I got this cover and it's wild. So I should be seeing my next one soon and I can't wait for that.
Now, when's that out? Is that out next August?
August 6th, which seems so far away, but it's actually like less than 11 months away. And I just know, like, you know, we're going to have galleys and probably another, you know, 3-4 months. I'm getting first pass pages. We've already gone through copy edits. Like the whole machine starts a year before publication when you turn in the manuscript and then you go through all the steps.
It really does. And you know what we're also seeing too is the Amazons and Barnes and Nobles of the world want it on their site 9 months before. Right. And then we're into orders of everybody pre-order. And then we're into this and then we're into that. And it's like this cycle that starts so much sooner for every single book. Yeah. And we also build websites for authors. So I'm like always in, are we doing the cover reveal like anytime soon? My two dreaded words are cover reveal, simply because we've got to time everything to work, you know, like what's going to happen. But I think that, the whole cycle has changed. It's not, 3 months before. It's not this, that, the other thing. It's really, really that 9 to 12 months before is everybody's really thinking what they're going to do with next summer's book. So now we've got the audio and Kate Mara narrates it. Now, did you select her?
Well, I mean, she was definitely on my dream list, but, you know, the audio department decides who to make an offer to, and I was praying she would do it and it would be her because I love her. I've seen so many of her shows and movies through the year and her voice is so great. And so they approached her and I was just kind of waiting, fingers crossed, and they came back and said she wants to do it. And I was jumping up and down. And then they came back to me again and they said, you know, would you like to fly out to LA and watch her record part of it? And I'm like, are you kidding me? And they flew me to LA and I met her. She was great, funny, like just down to earth, you know, just, you know, very, very serious about her craft, like watching her and the way she acted things out and the way she would say, no, let me try that again, was very cool to see that. But to also listen to her, like bring the book to life. She's in a soundstage. I'm, you know, watching her through a window on a couch, looking at her, and I got weepy because I'm like, this is really a special experience.
This is really great. Do you have a video of the two of you together that I thought I saw someplace too?
Yeah, we took pictures and I think they did some videos too. They had a photographer, videographer there doing it all. Right. So yeah.
I think there is something someplace because I definitely saw the two of you together. And so just for those who don't know Kate Mara, I know her from a different perspective because we're Giants fans and her family owns the Giants and her mother's family owns, if I'm the Pittsburgh Steelers, if I'm correct. So like we knew the Maras from football. So then all of a sudden the girls, Rooney and Kate started acting. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like so funny. I knew these people already. I remember seeing you on sidelines. You know, this is like totally different. Totally different. So anything you could share with us about the next book or is it still under wraps?
Oh, so the next book is set in DC, which is my hometown. The thing that's different about it, it is not a dual narrator. It is one narrator. Mm-hmm. Start to finish, it takes place over a very short amount of time. It was really hard to write, but I'm told it does not read that way, that it reads like, my editor, read it all like in a blast. I don't think I can tell much more about that. It's about a woman with a very unusual job and a case she gets.
Very, very interesting. Well, besides the fact that just writing one voice, it's going to be interesting to see what you do, because that will be something very different for you for what you've done before. Wow. Sarah, it's such great to see you again after all these years, to see you again. And thank you so much for joining us and sharing so much about this book, because I absolutely loved it when I read it. And I'm hoping readers have the exact same experience.
Thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate all your kind words and your great questions and the research you obviously did for this. And hopefully I'll see you next year, if not before.
Yeah. They have lots of pimple to down pages. This is what I did when I read the book. This is what I did. I love it.
It's a well-loved book.
A well-loved book. And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks so much for joining us. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Gone Tonight by Sarah Pekkanen, narrated by Kate Mara, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Macmillan Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Gone Tonight by Sarah Pekkanen, narrated by Kate Mara, courtesy of Macmillan Audio.
My mother walks through our tiny living room, her eyes sweeping over our old blue couch and coffee table, before she briefly disappears into the galley kitchen. I just had them in my hand. Her voice is tinged with something darker than frustration as she begins another lap. I should jump up from the couch and help her look for her keys so she isn't late for her shift at the diner. But I don't want her to notice I've begun to tremble. "Check your purse again," I suggest. She frowns and reaches into her shoulder bag. My mother is organized, methodical, detail-oriented. Her purse isn't a jumble of crumpled receipts and loose change. Sunglasses in a case, small bills facing the same way in her wallet, cherry chapstick and hand lotion zipped into her makeup bag. It's containers within a container. She shakes her head and walks to the raincoat hanging on a hook by our front door, searching through its pockets. Maybe her father is absent-minded. Perhaps her cousins grew distracted when they approached middle age. It could be something our relatives tease each other about when they gather for holidays. I don't know. I've never met them. When I had to create a family tree in the fourth grade, I was able to fill out only two names on a single branch. My mother's and mine. My stomach tightens as I watch her bend down and check around the mat by the front door where we put our shoes. She looks even thinner than usual in her uniform of black slacks and matching polo shirt with a red waitressing apron tied around her waist. She hasn't been able to eat for the past few days. At night, I hear her restless movements through the thin wall that separates our bedrooms. Tomorrow she has an appointment with a neurologist. Everyone loses their keys, I tell myself. The neurologist will have a simple explanation for my mother's strange new symptoms. He'll prescribe medication and advise her to get more sleep and send us on our way. But my pulse is accelerating. I force myself to inhale slow, even breaths. The worst thing I can do is fall apart. My nursing classes taught me about the power the body wields over the mind, and vice versa. Right now, I need a steady physiology to assert control. It works. After a minute, I feel able to stand. I walk over to my mom, thinking hard, then dip my hand into the big pocket of her apron. Relief crashes over her face as I pull out her keys. I'm losing my mind. Could you grab another box if the diner has any? I don't really need more moving boxes. I just couldn't bear to hear her complete that sentence. I already have a half dozen cardboard boxes I pulled out of a recycling bin behind a liquor store. I don't own many possessions, and I pack quickly. I've had plenty of practice. When families move out of houses in the suburbs, neighbors throw going-away parties, and the moms get weepy after a few glasses of wine. People like us, we move on to a new apartment, and no one notices. I'd planned to sort through my books and clothes this morning, but until we see the specialist, everything feels suspended in midair. My mom rises to her tiptoes to kiss my cheek, then opens the door and is gone, her footsteps growing fainter. I wait for silence. Then I reach for my phone and call up the list I'm secretly compiling. Misplacing her keys might not be another piece of evidence. Still, I document it along with today's date. Then my eyes roam over the dozen other incidents I've recorded of all the things my mother has lost. A $20 bill, her train of thought, her way home from the drugstore that's just a mile away. All happened within the past month.
Thank you for listening to this clip provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.